Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's the weekly program that makes science and technology relevant to all of us. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Well, this morning in the program, we'll be joined by Lauren Strawn, a scientist whose graduate work at the University of Utah focused on stem cells in the skin and other tissues. She'll decipher for us the research surrounding stem cells and how that new research may affect any or all of us.
And good morning. Next, are you a cat lover? Even if you're not, you'll find author and anthrozoologist John Bradshaw's new book fascinating. It's called Cat Sense: How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Bradshaw is the New York Times bestselling author of Dog Sense, and he'll join us the second half of the hour from London, and he'll take us deep into the mind of the cat and explain the true nature of our feline friends.
All that, plus today's cool story after this. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hola, soy Jorge, uno de los anfitriones de Cada Domingo. Escuche Cada Domingo en KPCW 91.9 FM todos los domingos en las tardes de las 7 a las 10 p.m. Tenemos música, información de la comunidad y perdidos y encontrados. Por favor, denle like o me gusta a la página Facebook de Cada Domingo. Cada Domingo, solo en Park City, solo KPCW. Hi, I'm Jorge, one of the hosts for KPCW's Cada Domingo. You can hear Cada Domingo every Sunday evening on KPCW 91.9 FM from 7 to 10 p.m., where you can hear music, community information, and lost and founds. Please like the KPCW Cada Domingo Facebook page. Cada Domingo, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Have you ever wondered how many calories you burn while you sleep, or how much your organs weigh, or how you can lower your healthcare costs and prevent many diseases? Live Well Center at Park City Medical Center has those answers and more. Whether you're hoping to lose weight or gain a competitive edge, Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment today for a healthy lifestyle evaluation, now covered by most insurance companies. Visit livewellcenter.org/PC for more information.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek here with my co-host John Wells. Well, when we think of stem cells, what does that conjure for us? Stem cell research has long focused on how stem cells can perhaps solve the mysteries of human disease and illness, but it also focuses on how stem cells can teach us a lot about what goes wrong with cells as they mature. Local Park City resident Lauren Strawn did her graduate studies in the field of stem cells, and she looks at how some of the most common birth defects and malignancies come from the misfirings of stem cells. And she's joining us in the studio now to help us sort this all out. And welcome to you, Lauren Strawn.
Good morning, Lynn. Good morning, John.
It's great to have you here. So, you know, let's go back to the basics, because I think, you know, in the news media for decades now, we've heard about stem cell research involving embryonic stem cells. But there's a whole world out there of stem cell research involving our own stem cells. So maybe you could just decipher that little bit for us.
Sure. So embryonic stem cells are basically the egg or the oocyte fertilized, and that's the ultimate definition of an embryonic stem cell. It is a totipotent cell, meaning it can create a whole organism or being, in this case a human. We often study mice because they're our closest mammalian relative, if you can believe it. Mm-hmm. 95% similar relative in the sense of an animal we can use in the lab to study. So that embryonic stem cell, being the most basic, is obviously a very controversial issue because it is the beginning of that life. And, you know, playing around with that, you have to be a little bit careful. So for many years, people have looked for alternative sources for a totipotent cell, another cell that could give rise to a whole organism or being.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what has recently been described as an induced pluripotent stem cell that was discovered in San Francisco, actually. The Nobel Prize was given for that work.
And that Nobel Prize was just, it was this year's Nobel Prize, wasn't it? Or was it?
I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly which year it was.
Okay.
But it was, what the work showed is that you can take a cell from the skin and you can reprogram it to become a pluripotent stem cell. Now, that is one step down from a totipotent stem cell, but you know, we don't really need to recreate a whole organism. All we really need to do for therapy is recreate or regenerate or fix usually just one organ, sometimes two, but oftentimes just one, the pancreas, the skin, the bone, one organ.
What is there a term that's synonymous with pluripotent cell that is in layman's terms that we might understand?
A totipotent cell, the definition is it can give rise to a whole organism.
Okay.
A pluripotent cell can give rise to every cell in that organism, but doesn't necessarily have the ability to carry off putting the whole thing together.
Okay. So in the case of a malignancy, say, in a stem cell, a skin cell, skin stem cell, there we go, a pluripotent cell may be able to do what exactly?
So that's another very interesting aspect of stem cells and what you're getting at, the malignancy part of it in terms of cancer, is the theory of a cancer stem cell, that cancer is literally driven by a cell that has the properties and ability to continually give rise to that organ, if you would call it in quotes, but unfortunately in this case it is a tumor.
Uh-huh.
It's a cancer of whatever tissue it's in. And oftentimes it's thought the reason chemotherapy doesn't work, why cancers come back, is because maybe you knocked out the whole tumor, but you didn't get the stem cell. And since it has the cancer stem cell, and since it has that ability to regenerate a whole tumor, you'll just get the tumor back. So, sorry, go ahead, John.
Oh, I was just going to... the research that's being done on this is fascinating, and there are so many projects going on that are showing great results. But there's also a lot of snake oil salespeople out there, and there's a lot of rhetoric. And we read an article, and Lynn and I were talking about it this morning in the New York Times, about 20 clinics that opened up across the border in Tijuana that are promising all sorts of possibilities, and people who are desperate are going down there and spending a lot of money on things that really haven't been researched properly. Can you separate what's working and what's not working?
So basically, we know a lot about the blood, and we have current cures and therapies for people with a lot of hematological malignancies. These are mostly the leukemias and the lymphomas. And these are people that get bone marrow transplants. There's a lot of childhood leukemias that we can cure. This is why donating your bone marrow is so important, or learning if you can become a match, because these are malignancies that we can actually cure. The reason we know a lot about the blood is because it is the tissue or organ, if you want to call it that, that we have studied for the longest in terms of stem cell biology. And that comes from our knowledge about the damage radiation can do to the blood. Other tissues and the ability to regenerate them or have therapies for those tissues, in particular the heart, you know, everybody wants some cardiac stem cells these days, is a little more challenging. There are clinical trials. They are ongoing. Everybody's working as hard as they can. But it takes a long time to develop these. And the fact that in the past couple of years, suddenly, over the border, they've magically solved all these, you know, malignancies is a little scary.
And I read that for the pancreas and for the heart, that stem cell regeneration of tissue only occurs under special conditions. So it's a little trickier.
That's true. You know, we've been working on the pancreas for a long time in terms of diabetes, and that is a very complicated organ. I mean, you know, that's not easy. And 40 years of research into, you know, all of the people wanting to help, you know, people with juvenile diabetes, which is a very scary and sad disease, has yet to give us a cure. Now, suddenly, 3 years ago, they solved this in, you know, Switzerland or Mexico, or I've heard of a lot of places that are offering therapies for.
So every time you read an article about stem cell therapies and the advances in stem cell, I mean, to what degree is someone like you trusting that? You know, obviously it's more credible if we're reading it in credible sources, but it seems like such a promising field, and yet maybe it's that very promise that is making the inflation of what it really can do.
You're right, Lynn. I think that's where the snake oil comes from, is that everybody kind of wants to hop on the bandwagon and claim that their therapy was a stem cell therapy. But the stem cell hypothesis, to prove that, is a rigorous, there's a rigorous test. A stem cell, by definition, has to be able to regenerate a whole tissue, a pluripotent stem cell, that is. And the only tissue that we've been able to study in that manner in a mouse is the blood. It is the only tissue that you can completely knock out, keep the mouse alive, and then put back one stem cell, and you know, you regenerate all of the blood of the mouse.
I have to interrupt you for a second, sorry, and ask you. You were explaining this to me before, and this is a really naive question I'm about to ask. But when you remove all of the blood, you're essentially you're replacing it immediately with blood from another.
So it doesn't. Sorry, it's poor English. You don't actually remove it. You lethally irradiate the mouse. So you put the mouse in the way of radiation, and the mouse without a blood transfusion will die. And when you give it a blood transfusion, it will survive if in that transfusion you have at least one blood stem cell. Now,
that's fascinating.
You know, you didn't have to do that before. You're just like, I need some mouse blood. You put it all in, the mouse comes back, you're great. But if you really want to study the hypothesis, you're going to fractionate that healthy donor mouse blood all the way down to one stem cell. And then you're going to put a bunch of non-stem cells in there because obviously one cell is not going to be enough.
Yeah, okay.
Volume. And you can literally rigorously test, did the mouse survive or not? It's a yes or no. It's a very strict test.
Speaking of naive questions, is there any difference between a fetus's stem cell and a 60-year-old's?
Which stem cells? Like, a fetus has all of the organs that a 60-year-old has. So do you mean like a fetus's potential heart stem cells in a 60-year-old's, or
sure, as they some of these organizations are encouraging people to store stem cells cryogenically, and I was curious as if they're marketing to 60-year-olds or 70-year-olds, if
is it too late?
So cord blood, that's a good question. I think is what you're talking about, mm-hmm. And there are tons of stem cells inside the umbilical cord, and that is why people store their cord blood. We're also finding evidence of cells even in the amniotic fluid, stem cells. It's very easy to make a good argument for the presence of a lot of stem cells in a young developing organism.
So there are more. Is that the thing? More at that stage.
Whether that's actually been shown, the frequency in a fetus versus a 60-year-old, I'm not sure. But that's kind of a common sense argument. To determine a frequency, you'd have to have absolute cell numbers, volumetric measurements. You know, this gets a little more complicated.
That gets a little sciencey,
right? So, I think what the basis of your question is, and what it kind of gets to, is one of the most talked about recent therapies are these adipose-derived mesenchymal stem cells, and that means fat stem cells,
right.
Taking like some fat from your belly and getting some stem cells and maybe injecting it into your knee or into your shoulder or eventually into your heart.
Or breast reconstruction. They've had some positive things with that recently.
That's right. In fact, even facial reconstruction as well. My understanding of that work is that isolating pluripotent cells from a six-year-old versus a six-year-old, the age is regardless. If the cell is truly pluripotent, then it's pluripotent. It can give rise to everything.
It's an unspecified cell that has tremendous promise.
That's true. Now, the only caveat to that is that that's just one layer of the complication. Sorry to bring this up, but you have another layer called epigenetics. And epigenetics is the layer on top of your just DNA. And that is a history of your environmental exposure to everything. And this is why you can inherit some things from your grandmother that maybe your mother didn't have because of epigenetic marks that get passed down. And so the 60-year-old is going to have had 54 more years of epigenetic marking than the 6-year-old. And that may make a difference. And we are just getting into epigenetic control of pluripotency.
Okay. Well, our guest is Lauren Strawn. She is a Park City resident, and she, well, obviously is well studied in the field of stem cells, having done her graduate research at the University of Utah. And now we're lucky to have her joining us as you're being a full-time mom right now,
right? That's right. That's right.
So this is good to keep your mind active, keep your stem cells doing their thing.
That's right. And watching my daughter's stem cells go crazy.
Exactly. Well, you know, playing on John's question, I know that, you know, there was this recent campaign about donating blood marrow for some local residents who needed it. And it was great. But they said if you're over, I think it was age 40, we don't really want it. And is that you know, did you just give the answer to that question?
That's part of the answer to that question. You also have been exposed to a lot more after, you know, the longer you've been around, and they're just going to have to do a lot more testing. It's probably a lot more likely that a 12 to 18-year-old maybe hasn't been to Africa and hasn't been exposed to certain things that they need to test for.
So. Okay. Okay. My next question is, going back to embryonic stem cells and the fact that they're finding there are stem cells in amniotic fluid, doesn't that take away the controversy? Because amniotic fluid is present in every live birth.
We're hoping. I mean, that's definitely.
And where is that in the
research? It's just starting. That's some of the most interesting research going on at the U with my former advisor. And one of the things that is great is that because of the identification of these induced pluripotent stem cells from the skin, which is easily accessible from a, say, pregnant woman, as well as her amniotic fluid, talk about a great setup for a great test. You've got the same woman, same individual. We can take her skin cells. We can take her amniotic fluid cells. We can put them to the test in the lab. We can get 500 other women in the same exact age and the same exact, you know, living environment. We can test all of theirs too. We're really getting someplace, especially in Utah.
Let's talk about cheeseburgers. Recently,
that's easier.
Yeah, it's much easier. Recently, hamburger made from cow muscle stem cells was grown in a laboratory, was fried, served, eaten in a London demonstration in an effort to make a case for in vitro cheeseburgers. What's going on there?
I'm not a huge fan of hamburgers, so I haven't been following that that story as much.
Well, basically, the gist of what they're trying to do is provide an argument that lab-made meat could provide food for the world's growing population while avoiding environmental issues related to livestock production.
I don't see why you couldn't do that. A cow is just another mammal. You study the muscle development of the cow, and you find the muscle stem cell, and if that's what a steak is, the muscle, then you just make another one. And I don't see why you couldn't do that.
Right. For people who have gone to doctors, they've been diagnosed with some serious health issues, and there's nothing for them. They're very frustrated. What can they do to make sure that they don't go the way of the snake oil salesperson?
Education, education, education. Speak to as many physicians as you can find or know. You know, every good doctor is interested in the plight of any patient and will research your plight for you. You just need to find those doctors. You need to find those physicians. There's tons of them in Park City, actually. And Winnie is the first person that comes to mind. But every good doctor will research those questions, and that's the most important thing, education.
Is there any credible work being done in Tijuana in these 20 clinics?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't want to discount Tijuana on a whole. I mean, you know, it's sort of like Chinese medicine. We don't know why arrowroot does what it does. I mean, maybe we kind of do or we kind of don't. We don't have clinical trials per se, or maybe we have one or two. I haven't followed it. But 3,000 years of empirical evidence is hard to argue against. And, you know, these Tijuana studies have only been around, you know, for a while. But if people, if they're safe, that's the most important thing. The place needs to be safe and clean. If that's your last hope, if people are willing to do this, they are important pieces of data. And that's a sad, scary way to say it, but it's true. If some people are cured this way, we can learn a lot from that, and we can learn a lot from some of the failures as well.
The problem is that they're reluctant to release any of their clinical trial data.
These companies.
They kind of roll their own.
That's right. And they also keep all of their data, you know, tight-lipped because they're a company and they, you know, want to make money. But the individual themselves are data points. Those individuals, say 20% of people come back moderately cured. I mean, those are data points, you know.
Yeah.
Before we go, Lauren, I wanted to ask you about, in the news media, we have heard, well, actually for a long time now, about stem cells and the possibility of therapy for Alzheimer's patients. And it's just resurfaced. I know it was kind of present after, I think, President Ronald Reagan died of Alzheimer's. And it surfaced again. So maybe you can update us on that.
It's not a particular area that I'm well-versed in. I know that one really interesting debate going on in Alzheimer's right now is actually regarding the cause. And for a long time, it was thought that these beta amyloid, I think it still is mostly thought that these beta amyloid plaques are responsible. But there are people, there apparently there's this huge fight between the Taoists that believe in the tau protein and the Baptists, and it sounds hilarious.
sounds kind of religious.
I know, but that believe in the BAP protein or the beta amyloid protein, and they're in big fights, you know, collegially with each other. And so that kind of, to me, not necessarily negates, but really makes quite confusing any of the current clinical trials, because if we now have a question as to what's even causing the disease, you know, then what are we looking at?
Mm-hmm. Just a stab in the dark.
That's right. That's right. And there are quite a few trials out there, clinical trials. You know, you can go to clinicaltrials.gov. Anybody can do this. Right now, the website is running on empty, but but you just type in what you're interested in and you can see what's going on. It's a fascinating way to kind of keep up with the science if you're interested. And there's like 5,000 hits come up for clinical trials for Alzheimer's and stem cells.
Mm-hmm. People are desperate.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the things that that Lynn and I have found fascinating over the last several months are a number of our guests talk about collaboration of different disciplines in working towards common mm-hmm. problems. And I was reading an article in the New York Times in April of this year. It talked about a young lady named Hannah Warren, who's a 2-year-old, who was born without a trachea. And this is a bioengineered organ that they developed for her using stem cells and plastic fibers to actually build a trachea for her. And this collaboration of different disciplines is just fascinating.
Yeah, that's super cool. You can do that in rats and mice too. The trachea is great because it's such a nice little windpipe. I mean, I'm thinking of that MASH episode, and he jams the pen in his throat, and like you really just need a plastic tube, and then
she's very aggressive. Did you see the way she moved her? You know, and an like in studio guest, you can see it's like one of those slasher movies. It's kind of scary.
Like that scene in Pulp Fiction.
It's good. I'm on radio.
So different.
Exactly. Alma Thurman.
Yeah.
Anyway, the nice thing about the trachea is that it's lined with cells that help, you know, kind of weed out dust particles and all sorts of things like that. So you don't just need the plastic tube. You need some cells inside of it. The cells that are inside the trachea are epithelial. That's the same thing as your skin. So it's pretty easy to remake an epithelia. And, yeah, that's the mixture between bioengineering, which is getting a fiber, an inorganic stiff column to be accepted by a human body, and the stem cell biology of getting some cells to grow inside of that and getting the right stem cells so that the two-year-old doesn't have to get a new transplant every year, right? If you put the stem cells in, grow with them, exactly, and continue to give rise to all the, you know, cells of that tissue for the rest of her life.
I think, Lauren, that you have really explained this quite well, and I've learned a lot here. I hope our listeners have too. And I want to ask you before you go about the University of Utah and the department with which you were studying and involved with. Are you seeing lots of great things coming out of there with research, and you know, what are the most exciting things? You mentioned a little bit about it before, but...
Yeah, so the University of Utah is just a powerhouse when it comes to biomedical research, and I'd be remiss not to mention Mario Capecchi. He is by far the most famous researcher there. He won the Nobel Prize, and what he won the Nobel Prize for, and what they renamed the street that goes right into the University of Utah after him, the reason they did all this is because he invented what is called the knockout mouse, and this is a term that is so important. Everybody should know what this is because this is the basis of how we study every single human disease. Most, if not all, human diseases have a genetic component. There's a gene that has gone wrong. And maybe you were exposed to something in the environment and that power, and bash that gene so long that it just couldn't keep up. Or maybe you were born with a bad copy of that gene, and therefore you couldn't keep up. So the best way to study the relationship of that gene to that disease is to knock out that gene and see what happens and bring it back in little pieces or take out half of it or whatever. And he invented the way to take a mouse and to do that. And now we have hundreds of thousands of strains of mice in this country and in the world that have specific genes or even parts of specific genes knocked out that different labs own or the government owns in the sense that they keep this strain going or the strain is cryopreserved or whatever. And this is all due to a man named Mario Capecchi.
Wow. I've
Can
Never
we get him
that.
On our
That's
show?
Great.
Yes, probably. He's very nice.
Yeah.
I've always seen that, the street, Mario Capecchi Drive, and had no idea. So thank you.
Exactly.
And Lauren Strawn, it's been really fascinating, and thank you for being a guest today. And stay with us. This is Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after this short word from our underwriters with John Bradshaw. He's the author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a better friend to your pet. That is, if you have a cat. Stay with us.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures, Zermatt Resort and Spa.
And the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
The ABC4 Weather Report comes to you live Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. after the NPR News. Brought to you by Albion Financial Group.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
In the cycle of life, we all go through changes, and menopause is one of them. At Intermountain Park City Specialty Clinic, our OBGYNs, Drs. Janine Falk and Lorraine Sabella, care for women at all stages of life. 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Okay, we are back. I'm John Wells with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We're just talking with Lauren Strawn, a fascinating, fascinating conversation about stem cells. And we're going to have her back, aren't we?
We will.
Yeah. Hey, cats and humans, they've been living together for 8,000 years. And despite the fact that cats have adopted to domesticity, well, they sort of adopt it, cats still maintain their need for independence to be predators and to be cats. Despite that, they can live in harmony with humans, especially if we learn some of the new science behind what makes them tick. Joining us now to talk about his new book that's a tell-all about cats, from their emergence from the wild to why they may or may not need humans, New York Times bestselling author John Bradshaw, and the book is Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning.
John?
Yeah. Hey.
Do we have
you? Hear me?
I can hear you, John.
Oh, good.
Well, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Why don't we start back with the history of cats? And you talk in your book about the emergence of cats from the wild. When did this happen? And what were they like then that they're not now?
Well, we used to think that cats came out of the wild in Egypt about 4,000 or possibly 5,000, 6,000 years ago. Now that we have the genome, the whole DNA of the cat, and can compare it with that of their wild ancestors, then we now think this actually goes back quite a lot further. I mean, maybe 8,000, 10,000 years to a very early stage in the human development of agriculture. So pretty much as soon as the house mouse had evolved to come in and steal our food stores, our grain and our nuts and everything, then the cats came in on the back of that, out of the wild, and very gradually over the course of a few thousand years adapted to living in towns. But I think at the early stages of that, they were pretty much wildish animals. They wouldn't really have been the sort of pet-like cats that we have today. That was a gradual process, and the first really good records we have of them being pets was indeed in Egypt, but they've been around, I think, for quite a long time before that.
And how would you compare those cats to feral cats today?
Well, a feral cat today is just essentially a domestic cat gone wild, and one of the key differences that we noticed between feral cats, which are descended from, you know, many, many generations of pet cats very often, and the wild cats that are otherwise, you know, kind of look pretty similar from the outside, but they behave quite differently. They both don't like people. I mean, feral cats generally, especially if the kittens, you know, don't meet people at all in their first 8 weeks, are pretty scared of people. And almost as scared, probably, as a wild cat would be. But the key difference is that feral cats are much more sociable with each other. They actually get along together, not invariably. Sometimes two of them will really take a dislike to one another. But they do live in stable family groups wherever they can. And that's something that is completely lacking from the repertoire of the wild cats anywhere in the world. So we identify that as being a key element of domestication, that not only have they learned how to become friendly towards us, but they've also at the same time learned how to become friendly towards each other and how to get along for, you know, many years at a time, not just a few days or weeks, but actually live together almost a whole lifetime.
And John, you mentioned earlier about Egypt. In your book, you state that archaeological evidence suggests that millions of cats were deliberately killed in ancient Egypt for mummification. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the Egyptians seem to have had what to us, I guess, today seems a slightly bizarre or even kind of split brain relationship with their cats. They started out initially, I think, of having cats as being pest controllers and then pets in the kind of conventional way we might think of them. But then the kind of the status of the pet cats, especially in the more affluent households, seemed to take on an almost kind of mystical quality, that the cat was thought of as being a very important part of the family, that there were, they would have a funeral, there would be special rites that the family would have to go through when their cat died. They would often build very complicated caskets to have the cat buried in. And that was very much focused on an individual cat. So these were, you know, cats with personalities in the way that we would think of them today as being individual and important. But at the same time, literally at the same time, you know, a few hundred yards away behind the temple, there would be, we now know there were catteries, which were breeding cats. They may have been bred out of sight, but I probably not quite out of smell and or sound. Lots of cats were bred, and eventually over the course of hundreds of years, millions of those cats were bred specifically to be sacrificed. They were almost certainly sacrificed in the cattery where had been born, but when they were about a year old, they were mummified, and then they were sold in the temples as items for people to sacrifice. In much the way that you or I would kind of go to a gift shop today and buy something, people seem to have gone into the temple, bought a cat, handed it over to the priest. So that kind of made them right with the deity for a while, and so they knew that there were cats in there, and the ones that have been investigated really do have cats in. They're not fakes. So they must have known that there was, you know, some cats were treated one way, other cats were treated another, and I think it's interesting that they were actually able to do those two things simultaneously.
And John, these were big cats. I mean, they were larger than today's domestic cat. They were larger than today's feral cats, which are roughly 10% larger than domestic. Why were these cats so big?
I think the short answer is we don't really know. I mean, we know that they were because we have enough of their skeletons. A lot of the mummified cats, even though there were millions of them, many of them just disappeared. They were turned into fertilizer, along with millions of other mummified animals, because, you know, the Egyptians didn't restrict these religious rituals to cats. Lots of birds and other mammals were mummified too. But we have enough to take measurements from and know that they were a lot bigger. We don't really know whether perhaps the wild cats were also larger at the same time, because that's less easy to date. At other times in the cat's history, at least locally, there seem to have been populations which were very small. I mean, much smaller than we would imagine a typical cat to be, with no large cats at all. None of them, no cats that were kind of a typical cat of today. So there does seem to be a little bit of flexibility in the cat's genome to allow it to at some point, you know, get larger and get smaller, but the reasons for it really seem to be, you know, somewhat mysterious. There's no real convincing explanation for it.
So in a sense, John, I'm wondering if we then somehow disable cats by bringing them or forcing them to adapt to domesticity. You know, they're smaller now. Doesn't that make them more vulnerable in the wild?
I don't think there's any particular evidence for it. I think the vulnerability more comes from, I think, their kind of dependence upon us. That unless they're born to a mother who can hunt effectively, they're unlikely ever to really be able to hunt for a living solely. They're still going to be dependent upon us for at least part of their food, however, you know, feral they become. You really only get, certainly in the United States or in Europe, you only really get concentrations of feral cats where there is some food being provided by people, whether it's accidentally or deliberately. So I think they go back to being semi-wild again, but they can't actually go right back very easily to the lifestyle of their wild ancestors, except in one or two places like Australia and New Zealand, which are rather different ecologically to Europe and America. They've been able to do that there. But I think it's more to do with the bending of their behavior than anything to do with the body, which is still pretty much that of a wild animal.
Right. It's so interesting, really, that we take away their most basic instinct, really, that is to hunt. Our guest is John Bradshaw. He's the author of Cat Sense and the best-selling author of the book Dog Sense. So here comes my question. I'm a dog person, John. And, you know, you have a chapter in your new book, Cat Sense, about, it's called Thoughts and Feelings. And I want you just to go into this, like the difference between dogs and cats and their thoughts and feelings. I mean, in my estimation, cats don't really have feelings. They might they have thoughts. I'll give them that. Not feelings. Not like my dog.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think the difference is, I think, is how those feelings are expressed. It's harder to spot what kinds of emotions are going on in a cat. Dogs really kind of wear their hearts on their sleeves. They express themselves all the time in the same way that we humans do as well. You can tell a way somebody you don't really know very well is feeling sometimes by the expression they have on their face. And I think the same would go for we can read our dog's emotions pretty accurately as well. The difference with a cat, I think, is not in what's going on inside, not the actual feelings the cat is experiencing, but in the way it's showing them on the surface. And one of the problems that cats have in this respect, if you call it a problem, I'm not sure cats would, but is their rather inexpressive face. The face is like, mm-hmm. almost like a mask. They can move their ears around and can sometimes indicate that they're angry by the way they're holding their ears. The tail is quite expressive. But we humans, because we, I think, expect the emotions to be in the face, can kind of write off cats as being unemotional animals because their faces don't give them away. And then there's all kinds of stuff we can do then with putting pictures of cats on the internet and putting captions on. And no one can really tell you that the caption's inaccurate because the cats all look the same. Whereas with a dog, you could easily go, you know, if you put a happy picture on the top of a picture, a happy caption on a grumpy dog, everyone would know it wasn't working. So I think that's where cats don't do themselves any favors, if you like, is that their faces are not very expressive. And so we tend to, or people who don't get on with them tend to assume they're unemotional. But I think they're actually very emotional animals, that we don't give them enough credit for it. You know, some of their particularly anxious states, cats can get very, very anxious. They don't necessarily show it in their behavior, but until it spills over into their health. And then some veterinarians are now coming to recognize that, yeah, the anxiety plays a major role in certain skin conditions in cats, in cystitis in cats, and that the medical causes may actually be secondary. Maybe the cat's emotion, which is a major cause of the disease. So I think you can't really, under those circumstances, call them unemotional animals. They're just good at hiding it.
And John, we're speaking to you, or you're speaking to us from England. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
There's a controversy going on about the UK's Mammal Society that produced this estimate that 275 million animals are killed each year in Britain by cats. I assume this is mostly mice?
Mostly mice, voles, that sort of thing. A fair number of small birds, of course, as well.
Yeah. Is there concern by this happening that they're upsetting the delicate balance, that they're maybe assisting other predators by getting mice and small birds out of the way?
I think there was that thought. Certainly when those figures date back about a decade or so. I think later they've been kind of revised downward slightly. I think they were something of an overestimate. There has been quite a detailed study now of what those figures actually mean in terms of populations. And it turns out that most of the animals that cats prey on, whether it's small mammals or indeed birds, and are not declining in the UK in the sorts of areas where there are lots of cats. They may be declining elsewhere, but for other reasons. But in the suburbs, in the towns and villages, those animals, I think partly because of people's awareness of the need to conserve those animals, are actually, if anything, increasing in their numbers. So the pet cats, I think, are not actually, I think it's decided now they're not really an issue. And most of our conservation organisations over here now have really come out on the side of other factors being really, like habitat destruction, being really responsible for population declines. Having said that, clearly there is there's an emotional element here that you know people do not like having little blood-stained mice being deposited on their kitchen floors in the morning, or at least many people don't. And that I think it would be good for the cats press, if nothing else, if people paid slightly more attention to reducing the number of animals their cats kill or indeed keeping them indoors so they don't get the opportunity.
Is the main issue that they hunt for sport and they don't hunt when they're hungry?
That is certainly, well, the second part of what you say is true. They hunt when they're not hungry. That is true. I mean, that is something that's been built into them, built into their wild ancestors by evolution, that they, because they prey on small animals that actually, I mean, there's not many calories in a mouse, something like 20 calories, or that's all in a mouse. So they need several of those in a day, which means they can't afford to just hang around until they feel hungry and then go hunting, because they might not kill for several hours. They have to do that on a kind of pretty much regular basis. Now, so it is detached, and a hungry cat, a fully fed cat, will still go out and look around for mice.
Right. I
think the issue is whether they're doing it for sport, because I think that is a projection. That is something that we imagine.
Right, exactly.
Well,
it seems like they have fun, you know, batting
around
and everything.
It seems like they have fun. What they're actually doing is, because they are not hungry, is they're not hunting very seriously. So they're going through the motions. I mean, normally not just metaphorically, but literally. They're doing the hunting things, and sometimes that they may actually catch a mouse. But the majority of cats, you know, either catch nothing at all or maybe one or two things a week at the most. There are a few that kind of catch a lot and give cats a bad name. But most of the time, when they're out and about, they're not really hunting. They are just looking around for stuff that's interesting.
John, we want to thank you for joining us this morning. John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, How the New Feline Science Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. Thank you, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We also want to thank Lauren Strawn, who joined us earlier talking about stem cell research.
And we want to thank our underwriters, of course, Prudential, Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and 350 Main, and the Spur Bar and Grill. Also remember, you can listen to archived public affairs shows on kpcw.org. And we'll be right back with today's cool story after this.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, attorney at law.
And we are back. This is Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. I wanted to mention that tomorrow's Fun Friday show features Oktoberfest and the Harvard Fest Fund, from pumpkins to chili. So, Fun Friday tomorrow at 6 minutes past the hour of 9. Lynn, what do we have up today for today's cool story?
Okay, well, sometimes current and colloquial language isn't even intelligible. We know this, anyone who, you know, has a teenager. At least, it seems that way to those of us outside of the group who uses the speech. The hashtagification
God, that's a word, huh?
of our language performs a function, sort of. But as a certain population speaks in hashtag, we realize that this is a linguistic coup that rivals no other, and I hope it's short-lived. I don't know if you have been party to or witness to someone speaking with hashtags.
No, but I've hunted mice.
Well, I want to play. This is hilarious. It's a clip from Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And it's Jimmy Fallon and Justin Timberlake speaking hashtag. Here it is.
Hey, check it out. I brought you some cookies. Hashtag homemade. Hashtag oatmeal raisin. Hashtag show me the cookie.
Sweet. Hashtag don't mind if I don't. Pretty good. Hashtag getting my cookie on. Hashtag I'm the real cookie monster. Hashtag no, 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 no.
Delicious, right? Yeah. Hashtag I did it all for the cookie. Hashtag LOL.
Hashtag classic.
Okay, I think you get what I mean now. Hashtag get it.
Hashtag get it.
So, I mean, I don't really know who it is out there speaking like this. I have heard, you know, teenagers talking like this, but it's mostly in jest. However, we know the modern use of hashtags was pioneered several years ago by one guy, Chris Messina. He's a Google employee. Now, he thought that it would add some sort of, well, it would diminish clutter in this world of tweets that would be otherwise 99% just gobbledygook, right? Because it's very cryptic. So if you put the hashtag in front of, you know, whatever it is, hashtag cool science radio, then it would be easier to organize material.
Or at least bring us to a higher level of confusion.
Yeah, there we go. But the origin just doesn't matter anymore because, linguists are now calling hashtagging a paralanguage, something like shoulder shrugs or, you know, even facial expressions or intonations. But those aren't as annoying and they don't get in the way. But if you're talking hashtag this and that and hashtag I can't even do it myself, yeah. It sounds more like a tick. You know, it comes off as something like a tick and irritating, maybe even more irritating than that other word we put in, like, all the time. I think it is. But I don't know. Maybe it helps people organize their own thought. I think it's a filler word.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I'm not sure. I don't embrace technology as quickly as I used to. I'm a big technical person, but some of these things come out and I have trouble warming up to them.
So what we found online was, you know, this someone pondering why we need this meta language or paralanguage when regular words have been working so well. And it was the New York Times decided to acknowledge the hashtag over the summer, believe it or not. It quoted Chris Messina with a line that ought to be evidence enough to indict the hashtag. You kind of have to be in the know, Mr. Messina says. So it's one of those jokes where you're like, oh, I see what you did here because you're on Twitter and I'm on Twitter. So we all understand each other.
Right.
I think it's interesting anyway.
Hey, it was a good show today.
Very nice show today.
I really enjoyed the stem cell research discussion. And I wanted to mention, you know who Arthur C. Clarke is. He's the writer of 2001, Childhood's End. He's also a knight. He was knighted. But he once said, "If you listen to the conversation we had about stem cell research, and you're excited about the promise, I just want to read this quick quote from Arthur C. Clarke. If we've learned one thing from the history of invention and discovery, it is in the long run, and often in the short one, the most daring prophecies seem laughably conservative." And I think that there's a tremendous amount of promise for this technology, and I'm looking forward to seeing what unfolds.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after this short word from our underwriter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Lost and Found. Traffic, weather, and local stories. Only in Park City. Only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures, Zermatt Resort and Spa.
And the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
Hashtag Cool Science Radio. I had to say that. Thanks for listening today.